Happy New Year, OUXers. Welcome to 2022. I can't wait for you to meet Steve Smith and partake in this conversation about design and development together, and of course, object-oriented UX and whiskey and OUXing whiskey. So Steve is a friend of mine. He is a software engineer, a UX designer, a serial entrepreneur, and just overall badass. His early company, Ordered List, was acquired by GitHub back in, like, I think, like 2015 or something. I think he does say the year in the episode. And after a pretty long stint as a product designer at GitHub, we actually met after that while we were both consulting on a very complicated project with our dear friends at Nine Labs here in Atlanta. He is the founder and lead designer at Box Out Designs, which is basically Canva for the sports industry. It's pretty cool. So before we get into our conversation with Steve, I want to make sure that you know that enrollment is open to cohort 6 of the Object-Oriented UX Certification Program. So this is a rigorous 10-week coaching program, and it starts on February 22nd. So if you're not interested in that, just skip over a few minutes. I'm going to be here talking about it for hopefully less than 3 minutes. But yeah, just feel free to do that 30 seconds forward until you hear Steve and I talking. But if you are interested, let me tell you a little bit about the program. So you can, of course, get all the details over on oux.com/certification, which is actually where I'm going right now to make sure I don't miss anything. So let me tell you about what you get in this program. So you get access to about 22 hours of video lectures. Those are dripped out on a week-by-week basis, but it is a lot of content. It is so much more than you're getting here on the podcast or reading the articles. It is everything. We go through the entire Orca process twice. We go through it really fast in the beginning, really high level, and then we go through it very in depth through the course of the week three through eight. And so we break it all down. We go into all the advanced concepts. We go into inheritance and junction objects and tree systems and conditional logic and multiple permutations of objects. You get one catch-up week in there, so there is kind of a little bit of a spring break in there, but it is quite rigorous. So definitely look at your schedule. And if you decide to do this, don't plan vacation. Don't plan anything. This course is no joke. It is a true professional upgrade. I have had multiple people say that have gone through this course that they learned more in these 10 weeks than they did in their master's program, their HCI master's. So I hold that very dear to me. So you could go spend two years doing a master's program, or just come and hang out with me for 10 weeks. Okay, so you get lifetime access to all of this stuff. So I'm constantly improving, constantly adding new videos. And of course, I'll tell you when there's new videos, but you're never going to get kicked out. You're going to always have access to these videos and whatever is the most up-to-date content you will have access to. You get 15-ish course exercises and assignments. And you get personalized feedback on each of those assignments. So you're going to be in with your entire cohort in the forum posting your assignments publicly. That is required. You have to post your assignments. And myself, the rest of the cohort, and your mentors, who I'm going to be talking about in a moment, will be providing feedback on those. You also get lifetime membership to the OAUX forum. So after the 10 weeks, you don't get kicked out. You stay in the forum and you can continue seeing what the next cohort is posting and the questions that are getting answered there. You can continue to ask questions there. You get weekly Monday office hours. So we go for 90 minutes every Monday and we answer all of your questions. That is at 12 p.m. Eastern time. It is recorded. So if you can't make a week here and there, it is recorded and you get access to those recordings the next day with timestamps and all that good stuff. You get two one-on-one calls with me to go over your stickiest questions. You also get, let's talk about the mentors, okay? You get unlimited access to your mentor. So you are going to be assigned to a mentor based on your interests. So if you're more on the visual design side, you're more on the development side, you're more on the content strategy side, you're more on the information architecture side, you're more on the design leadership side, you get matched with a mentor based on your interest. You're not just randomly matched with a mentor. And there will be about five to six mentees per mentor. So it's a very small group, and there you get a Calendly link from them and you can schedule one-on-ones. They'll also be there in the forum helping you out, but you basically get as much access as you want to these folks, as long as your schedule aligns. So, which is just an amazing perk. These, the mentors are folks that not have only have been through the program, they have been invited into the program based on their performance in the program, and then they've had to take an additional mentor test so that to show that they really understand the most advanced concepts and understand how to explain it. So not just anybody can become a mentor. So these are really the shining stars of the program. And then, of course, after you go through the program and become a shining star of the program, you can become a mentor too. It is a paid position. And it is also something with lots of other perks. We have mentor mastermind groups. So it's a really cool next step and something to look forward to. Hopefully you're already looking forward to becoming a mentor. It's pretty cool. You also get this valuable professional certification that people are actually looking for now. I didn't mention yet, but within the forum, we've got a job board within the forum where people post jobs for certified OUX strategists, which is really cool. So you get that certification, you get a profile on OUX.com and a certification that you can add to your LinkedIn as well. We've got all sorts of banners and graphics. You get a sticker. It's great. So also something that's just a really great way to show that you have this skill in wrangling complexity. There's so many other opportunities for career growth after you get out of the certification program. We've got OUX Happy Hour, which you basically get a shoe in if there's something that you want to talk about. You want to practice some public speaking. I have a stage for you to go on. That is something that I am so passionate about, is giving you next steps to continue to grow your career and to continue to position yourself as a leader in this industry, because I think that OUXers should be the leaders of our industry. So there's the OUX Happy Hour that you can speak at, the OUX podcast if you are starting to use OUX within your company, or if you have a very specific skill set. Maybe you are an expert in accessibility or SEO or content marketing, and you found this really interesting way to merge object-oriented UX with your skill set, I want to have you on this podcast. So I want to interview you. So there's so many other opportunities. I'm sure from listening to this podcast, you've heard other strategists on the podcast. That could be you. So before we go into Steve Smith, one other thing I do want to just point you to OUX.com/testimonials. I'm going there now. I didn't have it pulled up. Okay. We got some new testimonials coming in from cohort 5. Definitely go there and peruse this. If you're not yet convinced, just don't take it from me. Take it from the folks that have come through the course. So just a few excerpts. So this is the single strongest ingredient I've encountered in my career. I'm certain that OUX and the Orca process is what I've been looking for. Somewhere in here, somebody says you can start using what you learned day one. So literally the first day, first week, it starts becoming applicable. These are from design directors. These are from content strategists. These are from information architects. The lens I view the view digital systems through has changed, is more connected and cohesive. The Orca Toolkit has given me the confidence to take on complex projects at the drop of a hat. One of my favorite new ones is actually, let me scroll down, is from Jacob. And Jacob said, this is a game-changing methodology. I suspect your only regret will be that you didn't learn this sooner. I know I do. Okay, so if you've been thinking about doing this, cohort 6 is a great time to jump on, make 2022 amazing. If you have been perhaps I don't know, feeling like the last couple years is sort of just a mushy blur, I promise this course will punch some energy back into your career. You're going to feel energized, you're going to feel inspired, and you're going to honestly feel like you've leveled up. You will remember 2022 as a turning point in your career and your professional development. So as you can tell, I'm very excited about this. I'm going to stop talking about it, but if you have additional questions, feel free to email me at hello@rewiredux.com or just tweet me at SophiaVUX. I can answer any of your additional questions. Go to oaux.com/certifications to get all the details, to really peruse through. You can also get a free preview of the course where you'll see the course outline and you can click and get a free preview and watch some of the videos. If you have already started the self-paced masterclass, if you've already purchased the self-paced masterclass and you want to upgrade your self-paced masterclass to cohort 6, and for some reason you didn't get the emails, I sent out some emails, but sometimes they go to spam, and you don't know your discount code or you don't know how to make sure to, you know, put the money that you spent on the self-paced masterclass toward the certification, because that is how it works. The self-paced masterclass is basically a down payment. So if you are having any trouble with that, you don't know where your discount code is, just email us, hello@rewiredux.com, and we'll get you set up. All right, let's go talk to Steve. Welcome to the Object-Oriented UX Podcast, a podcast about tackling complexity head-on, gracefully organizing massive amounts of information, and designing scalable, future-proof, and of course, naturally intuitive object-oriented user experiences. An OUXer is a powerful blend of information architect, business analyst, facilitator, and UX strategist. If this sounds like you or what you aspire to, you are so in the right place. I'm Sophia Prater, UX designer, chief evangelist of Object-Oriented UX, and your host. Let's jump into it. Steve Smith, welcome to the Object-Oriented UX podcast.
Hi there. Thank you. This is great.
You excited to talk about some OUX?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Cool. All right.
This is good times.
Yeah, it's going to be good times. All right. So let's start with you and a little bit of your background. So you're kind of hard to put into a category. if I had to make you decide, are you a designer who codes or are you a developer who designs?
I would probably say a designer who codes, although I still think that as a developer, you're still designing software. Like you're designing the code that you're writing. There's a lot of architecture that goes into it that is design anyway. It's just a different type. And so I approach things much more like designer.
Right. And I read something you wrote like in 2015 or something that like your process is very much squooshed together. Like you do a little bit of design and then you're like getting into code as soon as you possibly can.
Yeah, that one that I basically said that I don't know how to design things without building them. Like if I just stay in pictures for too long, I don't know how it feels. And that's the important thing to me is like the user experience of like feeling the software and how it works and like working your way through it. It's difficult for me. I'm sure there are people out there who have a much better imagination than me, but I like to get in and get tactile with the stuff as soon as possible, whether that be coding it or prototyping or something. But that is a big part of the process, is like getting out of the design tools and into the actual software.
Right. And so my solution for that, instead of learning to code, was kind of object-oriented UX, was like, okay, how can I start thinking about the structure of this thing from a back-end perspective? Like, how are all of these concepts going to actually work? At least a little bit. You know, I know a developer would bring so much more to that, but so that I was getting out of just a bunch of pictures and really feeling out the internal backing of what those pictures would be. And then it eventually just flipped for me completely, where I would start with that and then go into the pictures.
Yeah. I mean, you have to understand like how the data that you're going to use is going to be presented and how it's going to be organized in order to effectively model your stuff. I remember back in the day when I was working more directly at Ordered List with my buddy John Nunemaker, who's a much better developer than me. We would have these discussions around, you know, I would come up with these designs for stuff, and he would go to review it to start building out stuff that would need to be, you know, the data and everything for it. And he'd look at certain sections and he'd be like, wow, that's going to be a lot of work, like that to aggregate that data together and like to show that number and to do what you're doing there is a pretty large development effort. And I would oftentimes just be like, I just put that there to like balance the visual. It's not even important. Like it doesn't even matter that that needs to be there. We can put something else there. It just was supposed to like help balance something out. So like we can totally do something else. Or there would be times where it's like, no, that's actually really important to the user experience. And that's like a very key thing. And he'd be like, okay, great. We'll figure out how to make it work. But there's this balance of like, what is the actual important stuff that you need to show? And that's how you can orient your data and your storage to most effectively optimize, you know, how you work with that data.
Right. I mean, it, and I think so many times those conversations don't end up happening between the designer and the developer. And right. What you get is you get a designer who's like, I want this little piece of data over here. And then the developer ends up doing backflips, yep. Like make that piece of data happen and like throws off the timeline when like, if a conversation had just happened, then... Yep. You know, it could have been like, oh, well, you know what, if we just did this instead, like that would basically give the user, you know, 90% of the benefit. And like, it would, that would mm-hmm. take you 2 hours instead of 2 months.
Yeah, absolutely. There's certain concepts around, you know, when you're writing data storage as a developer, you know, things can be either write heavy or read heavy. And that really changes how you store things and the way that you sort of orient your data, which is, you know, how is it going to get used? And, you know, if you're doing that, if you're designing your data blindly based on like, well, I think this is how we'll need to use it, you're going to do it ineffectively. Like you're going to mm-hmm. store things wrong. And then you're going to have to, like you said, do backflips. You know, you're going to have to do a bunch of join table. You're going to have to do a bunch of stuff to actually present it. When if you just known how it was going to be used and had those discussions, but, you know, you have to at least have people talking a similar language at least. And a lot of times it's not even just for mockups, right? It's about, you know, seeing a workflow and like, this is the way the data flows and here's how we're going to read that and how we're going to present it, which can really affect not just how you store stuff, but, you know, any metadata that you store on objects and, you know, that brings to light a lot of these, you know, join objects, you call them junction ones, I think.
Yes, junction, join, bridge. Yep. But yep, all yeah, we settled on junction.
There we go. That's perfectly fine. And as long as everyone speaks the same thing, then that's great. But you know, we have to make sure that, you know, designing and developing are not like two separate isolated things. Like they happen in tandem together, and they need to happen together, because otherwise, you know, you lose a lot of the soul of the software that you're making, because it just is like, well, I made this thing and then I'm handing it to you to finish. And there's just a disconnect in between there. And I've never liked that. I like to be a part of the process.
Wow. So tell me more about how you lose the soul, because I love to think about collaboration. And, you know, I think that the object map is a great way for the tech experts and the design experts and the business to kind of come together and see, get like this x-ray vision around what mm-hmm. the thing is. Now, if you're not doing that, if you're doing that handoff, you're doing a bunch of comps, you're doing a bunch of red lines, you're doing, and from a design perspective, I'm sure you've worked with designers before that not only are kind of arbitrary about the data, they're not thinking about the data at all. Like they don't really understand data and how data works. So you get that, you get a bunch of pictures that, you know, the data has not really been considered. And then you get thrown over the wall to the developers. How that one, that's not gonna, you know, communication is great, but like, how does that end up with like losing the product, like kind of like loses its soul when you do that?
Well, you know, it's implementation without any like art effect. Like I've said this too, like I think it's really important that designers learn some about development so they can have those conversations. I also think it's tremendously important that developers learn more about design and, you know, just have some artistic taste, understanding, you know, the implementations of like just basic things like, you know, consistent paddings, you know, tasteful animation transitions, stuff like that, where, you know, when you go to implement a picture or even a prototype, there's so much to consider about the actual execution of that thing, because software is not a still object. So there's a lot of inference that a developer takes and a developer does when they take just a still photo. And without either like an artistic ability to infer like and take that to the next level, you have to be able to work with a designer to execute those minute little details that really do change how software feels when you're using it. It seems really obvious to me a lot of times when, like you said, stuff gets thrown over the wall because there's just no, like the execution just feels plain and boring compared to like these little tasteful things that it are really difficult to design and to give to someone to implement without, unless you know how to implement them in the first place. And so, you know, working together until you have those skills is like wildly important. And so like being able to talk in the same language about the software and having sort of a cross meeting of those two skill sets is terribly important.
So I've been watching a whole lot of the Great Pottery Throwdown, kind of got through all of the Great British Baking Show, and so I've transferred over to pottery. So have you done any pottery before?
Yes, I took ceramics class in college, and so have done a decent amount of things. Yeah. Not like any expert level, but yeah.
I did it in high school and loved it. But in watching it, I got reminded of the technique of scoring and slipping. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, if you take two pieces of pottery and you just stick them together without scoring and slipping, without like to get them to kind of meld together, and you put it in the kiln, it's just going to break apart, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So like, I almost feel like a designer and a developer need to be like scored and slipped so that they can like come together to create something, or you just need to be like primed, I guess is the metaphor. You need to be primed to like, okay, somebody else is going to come in, and how do we sort of interlock and overlap at like a, kind of like at a molecular level so that what we create holds together.
Yes, I equated a lot of the time to like, instead of just like to complete the whole picture, it's not like two blocks that are next to each other. It's like two wedges that are sitting on top of each other. Like someone's skill set, like in development, is way higher on one end. And as they go towards design, their skill set drops down. But the other person is high up on design and drops down. So when you put those two things together, you have the whole window is taken up. But there's still, it's not like someone's skill set or responsibilities just stop at one point and the next person's pick up at that point.
Oh,
there's a ton of overlap that is necessary.
We know this with craft, it's scoring and slipping with dovetail joins and carpentry. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. Yep. Like you just put two pieces of wood together and the yep. join is not going to be strong. Do some nice dovetailing and you're mm-hmm. going to have a piece of furniture that stands the test of time. So, correct. Oh, that's a nice visual. That's basically what we should be like. Let's back up because I wanted to actually talk a little bit about your history, because we've known each other for a few years. We got to know each other better at Web Whiskey Weekend. That was cool. We'll get to that in a bit. But I was doing my due diligence, doing my internet stalking before we got on this podcast together. And I realized how much I don't quite understand
your sort of order up operations to get to where you are now. So like, can you back up and sort of give me a bit of your history, like the whole, I'm especially interested in like the ordered list, GitHub story, and then getting to what you're doing now, which I think is the box out designs. Is that now?
Yeah, amongst other things. Yeah, yeah, that's the big one at the moment.
Okay.
I had been making software, if you want to call it that, since high school. The first things I ever wrote were, I wrote in, I think it's TI Basic on the TI calculators.
I would
program those and like make stuff so that my math homework was easier, because I'm a huge nerd. And then got into like HTML and CSS. I made a website about I used to keep these African cichlids. I made a website for that, and that was a cool
learning experience. African what?
Cichlids. It's a certain type of fish. Yeah. because again, I'm a huge nerd.
But very niche, I got really there.
Aquarium stuff, yeah, when I was in high school. And then, you know, learned some C in high school, and then Perl and PHP and some other things, but never really thought about it as like a job. I don't know why. It was just like a fun hobby thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got into college and realized that I didn't want to go to grad school because I was majoring in physics. And the only thing you can do with an undergraduate degree in physics is go to grad school, basically. And I just was done with school. So I was like, well, I got to do something to make a living. So I was like, well, software was fun. So I like studied a bunch my senior year and got better, and then got a job at a marketing agency, a web agency right out of college. Worked through a couple of those agencies. And then moved to the University of Notre Dame to work in their web department, building both websites and applications. From there, it was, well, this has been 2007, I think. I basically was like, I've always wanted to go out on my own and start like a consultancy. And it's sort of like a now or never type of thing. Like, I'm either going to, I'm going to regret it if I don't try this. So I was like, all right. So I quit everything and opened for business, knowing that like, if I have to go get another job, if I have to, you know, stock shelves at a store, that's fine. I'm totally fine doing that. But I got to try this. It worked and got enough business to begin making a living. And over the next 5 years, hired a few friends of mine. Ordered list grew to 5 people. And then by 2011, 2012, we had built a few apps and were acquired as basically an acqui-hire by GitHub. 5 of us were. So we worked there. I was there for 5 more years, basically. And moved on because I had this other app that I had been tinkering with that was really fun and thought it might as well, let's make it work. And that is Box Out Designs, Box Out Sports, which is the current app that I'm working on. And it's, yeah, in your notes, you said it's like Canva for sports. But yeah, it's basically social media graphics for sports teams, sports organizations, colleges, high schools, to both produce their own social media content as far as like still and motion graphics,
mm-hmm.
And also the workflows around that. So being able to give limited access and limited design power to coaches and student workers and various things. So sort of distributing that workload to other people in New York.
And how many teams are using it now?
Oh gosh, we've got probably 1,500 colleges and high schools across the country.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's really, really fun. And the sports world is great. I told people that it's great going and doing software for sports people, rather than developer tools. Because my whole life before that was like developer tools. I made software for people like me, which whenever you do that, everything gets picked over and like scrutinized yeah. like crazy. Every little detail of everything is like, well, you could have done it this way, whatever. And in the sports world, every piece of software is so bad that like you make anything halfway decent and people, their minds are blown. They're like, yeah. this is the greatest thing I've ever seen, I've ever used. It's so nice.
That must be nice. Just, like, be able to the relax. Bar is low.
Yeah, it's awesome. But yeah, so that's, and also I just, I love sports. So it's a fun world to be in. So,
yeah, I know what that's like creating tools. I mean, I've got some developers, in the OUX certification, but it's mostly designers. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean the bar is very high, you know, one of my my favorite testimonials, was you could tell that this was created by a UX designer. I was like, oh, but they definitely are. They don't hold back with the feedback. I'll say that.
No, designing for designers is tough. I mean, in a good way, like it tests your mettle a lot, but,
yeah,
you gotta be on your game. So
for sure. So physics. So I'm reading, not, I don't know how much I'm understanding, but I'm reading The Grand Design now. Which is, of course, kind of about quantum physics and the universe, and a lot of physics. I actually loved physics in college. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting because it is so much about breaking things down into their component parts, figuring out the rules around those things mm-hmm. and how those things yep. interact with each other.
Yep. Yeah, that was the fascinating part to me, was like, we can explain everything around us with mathematics. Like that's the fact, like it blows my mind every time I think about it. And it was just so interesting. I had no idea really what I wanted to do with it. But it was so cool to learn. And I'm so happy that I did. And at the end of it, it's just problem solving. Like it's, yeah. like you said, it's breaking down a problem to understand something into its individual pieces and organizing those and understanding each one and how it works. And so it, you know, it teaches very sort of linear thought processes and, you know, critical thinking and all sorts of stuff like that, mm-hmm. that is wildly helpful in all sorts of other stuff.
Well, linear thought process, but also systematic, like systems thinking about right. How do you isolate a system? How do you create the rules around this system? And then like, oh crap, like how does this system reconcile with this system over here, which has slightly mm-hmm. different rules. And then we have to figure yeah. out like, how does gravity and electromagnetism work together? Because right. we figured yeah. out those and individual then, systems.
And then like, you know, being able to see two different systems and like you're sort of evaluating those two systems and inventing like how you would describe them and how you understand them. And you know, two or three systems aren't exactly the same. And then you sort of step back and you're like, these probably should be the same. Like, it's weird that they're not. Mm-hmm. And so stepping back and realizing like, if there's too many things that are different here or too many things that are complicated, it's probably wrong. I've been wanting to give a talk about this forever. I never will probably, but I had a talk in my head called like Everything I Know About Design, I Learned from Science. And like the big thing was always like all these breakthroughs in physics and science, were always this, like, if the equations are really hard and the math is really hard, it's probably not quite right. Like there's probably a more elegant solution out there. What we have is a pretty good approximation and like, but it's a complex and more difficult approximation than the truth is probably, but we just haven't broken it down to understand it enough to be able to explain it more simply. Which I think is a huge rule for software and UX. Yeah. You know, if something is too complicated, you're probably doing it wrong. And so you have to break it down and understand it better in order to explain it better and present it better.
Yeah. I mean, if you have a ton of exceptions, a ton of edge cases, a ton of like error handling, even like, why do we need all of this error handling? Maybe mm-hmm. we should be doing some error prevention instead. It's just one example of that. But yeah, I can. And the cool thing about being able to see the structure and not thinking just in screens, like seeing the bones of the thing first, is you can start to see those weak points. You can see the mess comes alive for you. The mess becomes visual for you. And then you can tackle that structural issues before you get into like all the issues of the skin, really.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yep. Yeah, you got to have good bones for it.
Yes. Okay. So I feel like we're kind of moving into some object-oriented UX territory, and I want to hear that talk. Why do you say that you'll probably never do it?
I don't know. I haven't given a talk anywhere in years. But you know, maybe I'll flesh it out at some point.
You can come talk to OUX Happy Hour. We're a real easy audience.
Sweet. All right. I'll see if I can.
2022. All right. So we've done a little bit of OUX work together. So we worked together on a mutual client through Nine Labs. Shout out to Jay Cornelius with Info Tycoon. And, you know, we were kind of like a little bit like ships of the night in that on that project. We were kind of coming in and out of it. But more recently, we actually did some object mapping together at Web Whiskey Weekend, which it's more fresh in our mind. Info Tycoon was like 2017 or something. Probably a little bit more fun to talk about too. But before we kind of go into like how we OUX'd Web Whiskey Weekend, you've been going to Web Whiskey Weekend for a while. So maybe can you just kind of like, for those that have no idea what this is, can you kind of describe what this event is?
Yeah, well, it started with, just people that we would meet at conferences, right? Like at South by Southwest or whatever else. And what would end up happening is like we'd have this little niche group of people that would pretty much just hang out with each other all the time, like either go to the bar or go to lunches and stuff. And we would skip a lot of the conference because we were getting more valuable information from the people that we were with rather than listening to some talk that was without context. Like you could actually ask people questions that were real about and give them context about your difficulties, and they could give you real advice based on their personal experiences. And so we kept doing this, and we kept meeting at conferences, and we kept like hanging out and skipping the conference. And eventually we were just like, at some point we should probably just rent a place and go hang out, like instead of paying $1,000 conference fee that we don't go to a lot. We should just go hang out ourselves. And finally, Jay, being the wonderful organizing human that he is, said like, fine, we're just going to do it. And we booked a cabin north of Atlanta and people flew in. I think the first year we had like 14 people come. And we just had Web Whiskey 6 and there's close to 40 people there. So it's grown a lot, but just a really fun time of, there's no agenda. There's no schedule. Just hang out with great people and learn about being a good human and get some professional advice along the way. Give some professional advice along the way, but really just enjoy the company. It's a really great time. One of my favorite times of the year.
The agenda is basically eat really good food.
Yep.
Go play on a trampoline, maybe go do some yoga on a dock. Maybe there's a volleyball game going on. Eat more really, really good food, sit in the hot tub. it was really fun. This year was my first year. I'd been like meaning to go for the last 3 years, finally made it happen. And it was really awesome. We did it in a really safe way. I think Jay was great about organizing it. Yes. And I think next year Jay's talking about kind of growing it even more, being able to have more rooms. So for those that are listening and think this sounds like a good time, make sure to, I think there's a website, Web Whiskey Weekend. You could Google it and bookmark it, probably a mailing list or something, but it usually happens in October. So would love to see some more OUXers there.
Absolutely.
So we were standing around the whiskey table and the whole point is you bring bottles of whiskey, right? So there's lots of really, yes, really nice whiskey. And then there's kind of this competition aspect of like who brings the best whiskey. Just a ton of great bottles of whiskey. And sometimes those bottles of whiskey carry over from year to year. So, you and I and Gina Ann of Design Systems fame, were standing around the whiskey table talking about what like the dream Web Whiskey Weekend app would be. And we were chatting and I was like, do y'all want me to go get my sticky notes? Because
yeah,
I brought them, of course, you know, right, just for this scenario, yeah, like if yeah, the opportunity came up. So I had mm-hmm, my stack of my blue and my yellow and my pink and my green sticky notes. And right, and y'all gave me the go ahead. You gave me a somewhat enthusiastic yes. And I just like literally ran to my room to go and get my sticky notes. Like before they leave, they're going to walk away. I gotta catch up. So I run to my room and get my sticky notes. And like, do you remember like that? What happened next?
Oh man. Like just started like, all right, what are the objects that we got? Where do we start? And it's like, well, obviously whiskey is step one. And then, you know, you move on to like, well, you'll have ratings and you have events and then like, how do those things interact? And yeah, it was, and then some good debate about, what type of objects we would need to have beyond that was really interesting.
Yeah. So I kind of like, and the cool thing about it was, is, you know, it'd been a while, if ever, that I guess you'd seen the Info Tycoon object map a while ago, but it had been a while. And Gina Ann definitely was really enthusiastic about object-oriented UX. You know, she brought me to Clarity Conference, which was amazing. She kind of saw the value that OUX could have with design systems. But we'd never done any like object mapping together. And the cool thing was, is like, y'all just got it. Like, I didn't explain anything. I just started putting stuff on sticky notes, but y'all are like nodding your head and you're like, okay, I get it. And it really took, I mean, I think that there was like almost zero learning curve. I like put a key at the top, like blue is objects, pink is metadata, yellow is core content. And we're going to throw some green CTAs on there. And it just kind of, it was really encouraging to me to see how it just kind of clicked. One thing, so I'm trying to think of like some of the interesting, more gritty conversations we had. And one of them was we had a concept of whiskey and then a concept of the bottle. And that was something, so we started, because once the sticky notes really started exploding everywhere, kind of like people got curious about it, right? So we had people kind of rotate in and out of the conversation, come and look at the object map and try to make sense of it. And one thing that was really tripping people up, I felt like, is that, okay, what's the difference between whiskey and bottle? And some people were not convinced that those needed to be two different things.
Yep.
So why is it important? So whiskey being like, Talisker 10 or something like that, it was a scotch, okay. I picked a good one. Or one of my favorites from that weekend was Angels Envy Finished Rye. I'd never had that one before. Oh, yeah. So that being the whiskey, but then there is the bottle, which is like the bottle that Jim Caruso brought this year, but like maybe somebody had brought Angels Envy Finished Rye, like maybe you had brought it in 2017 mm-hmm. or something like that.
And in my mind, and again, my experience from when I learned about OUX from you, I saw what you were doing. I was like, oh, this is data modeling. This is what I do every time I'm making an application. Like I literally write these things down before. I have like notes in my phone, probably pages of notes of apps that I want to build or have built with literally object maps just written mm-hmm. out in them. So it's like, I was like, yeah, this is obvious now.
Right.
As a quick side note, I told Sophia that the only frustrating thing to me about OUX, is that I didn't think of it first. it's incredible. I love the concept. It's really, really useful. But So when I'm thinking of this data modeling for that, when you start with just whiskey as like the core object of everything, there's a lot of things that relate to that object. You have events, and you have, you know, a whiskey is brought to an event. So you have to store that somehow. You have to point out that whiskey is stored with an event. So you end up with like a event whiskey thing, right? And then like you'll have ratings, each whiskey will have a rating. So you might have like whiskey ratings, but then a rating is tied to an event also. So like you have like a whiskey event rating, and you end up with like these, like a bunch of these little separate metadata pieces that if you just treat whiskey as this ethereal concept of what the whiskey is. But from a physical standpoint, you bring the bottle to an event. And so with the bottle, you have the bottle goes to an event, the rating goes to the bottle, which ties to an event then, and everything gets a lot more simple when you have this object that everything else gets attached to that is just associated with this generic concept of whiskey. Because then that lets you burrow down to say like, well, I want to see every rating for this whiskey that was brought to an event. And that's just the ratings on the bottle. Or you could look at every rating from the event. And then you just look at all the ratings for each bottle that was brought to the event. Or you want to see all the ratings for one particular whiskey. So then you collect all of the bottles and then you get the ratings for those. It becomes a really clear path to get to all of your data rather than having to have all these little extra foreign keys and metadata everywhere to say like, well, this relates to this whiskey maybe, and this relates over here. It's just you're drawing a bunch of arrows when it could just be this object that collects all that data together that is related to what we want it to be related to.
And that's like, what I think happens is language is messy. And what I mean, the beginning of the ORCA process. So ORCA stands for objects, relationships, CTAs, and attributes. CTAs being calls to action. So what are the objects? How do the objects relate? What can people do to the objects? And what are all the attributes of those objects? And the very first, we do it in rounds. So we have a discovery round and then a requirements round and then a prioritization round, which I hope we get a chance to talk about prioritization. Yeah. But the input of this is noun foraging. So like go and look at existing apps, competitors' apps, user interviews, stakeholder interview transcripts, like, and just find the nouns that are getting used and start trying to like then connect the nouns. And somebody might say, oh, I brought this whiskey to the event.
Yep.
And so we might think, okay, like somebody brings a whiskey, but they don't. They actually, what they're doing is they're bringing a bottle, which then the bottle has a parent whiskey associated to it.
Right. And then, so the other thing that I always think through is coming from a developer side, when you have object-oriented software, you have this concept of, you have class variables and you have instance variables. And this is something that you learn pretty early on when you're doing object-oriented programming. And that gets explained like you have the class object is like a dog, right? And then like your pet is an instance of a dog. Like that individual entity is an instance of this broader concept of a dog. That's an instance variable. And so like, it gets really easy to think through that train of thought. And I think of it that way with like whiskey is this ethereal concept of a thing. And then the bottle is more of a specific implementation of that thing that we interact with. And then the whiskey itself can be this digest that's just a singular entity, right? What you don't want to end up doing is, for instance, creating a whiskey for every single event, right? Like you don't want to have to say like, oh, I brought a bottle of Talisker 10 to Web Whiskey 2018. I brought another bottle of Talisker 10 to 2019 and then to 2021. You don't want three separate objects there. You want one object of Talisker 10, and then you want to say, I brought that bottle to this event and this event and this event, and those are three separate things, but you want the whiskey itself and all of its metadata to only exist once in your system. And then you relate everything to that.
And we had actually a lot of conversations. I actually want to go back to class instance versus
instance variables.
Instance variables. But yes. We did have an interesting conversation about what does the review attach to? I remember debating about this. I was like, no, you review the whiskey. It's like through the bot, I just like that whiskey. I don't particularly like this. I don't have any love for this particular bottle of whiskey. But then you made the good point is like, what if you wanted to see how your taste changed? So what if you wanted to see like, okay, when my palate was not as sophisticated in 2021, I really didn't like this peaty scotch, particular peaty scotch. But then like 2 years later, oh my gosh, it was my favorite one. So I might have, then it kind of cleans it up because Sophia has a review for this bottle, this.
Yep.
Or is it the event? Is it like the event and the whiskey come together?
Well, that's the nice thing is if you have this concept of a bottle and an event that relates to a whiskey, right? So while your review, while I do fundamentally agree with you, you are reviewing the whiskey. If you just attach a review to a bottle, you automatically get that attachment to an event and and the review attaches to a whiskey also. So like you just sort of get that metadata for free along there. It's entirely possible for you to rate a bottle maybe twice during an event. You could rate it once at the beginning and then rate it at the end and say, today it was different or whatever. Like there's all these options for you. But if the bottle is what stores all of the metadata past that, then that bottle is tied to an event and tied to a whiskey, then you get all this like triangle of data that allows you to sort of introspect things in a really interesting way.
But what about the bottles that carry over from year to year because it doesn't get finished? So does it actually make sense for a review to just have an event and have a whiskey and then be associated to the bottle by proxy of the event and the whiskey?
Well, I do appreciate that, like, whiskey is not as different as wine, I think, would have a bottle is a very important thing, right? Because like sometimes one bottle of something is actually quite a bit different than an identical bottle of the same thing.
Right.
Whiskey isn't that much variation. But like, and again, this comes to the point where language is key, right? In my mind, bottle is just a convenient, nice word to that is like event whiskey.
So if it carries over, though, do you create a new one? Like if a bottle has been there for 2 years?
Yeah, I mean, you could absolutely, if you wanted to note that I'm bringing the identical bottle back to a different event, then all you need to do is bottle wouldn't have an event ID on it. You would have a bottle event table that relates this bottle is at this event. And then you'd be able to get that data through there. And then you could bring one bottle, which would have reviews, could be brought to multiple events. It could be tied to one whiskey. It just depends on how you want, like this is a really great point, which is if that's what you want to be able to do, and that's important to the user experience, you have to model your data that way in order to be really effective. And so these are the discussions that are great to have before you begin building stuff, because doing these relationships afterwards is really difficult. Moving data around and doing like data migrations is the worst. It's so painful a lot of times. And so like you have to put in a bunch of work to make sure that your data is correct at the beginning. And it makes everything down the path of building and testing and experiencing software so much nicer.
Right. I love how you just pulled it out, because I was about to pull it out. I was like, we could totally go down the rabbit hole of Web Whiskey Weekend here. But the point here is the conversation. So speaking to the listeners here, the conversation that Steve and I just had is the exact type of conversation you need to be having with your business, your users. Like, you need to figure out what is the truth. Like, what is the truth of Web Whiskey Weekend? Like, the truth is that a bottle carries over multiple events. Like, that's just true. So you figure out what is the truth of the real world, then talk about how do we model that truth? How do we really get to what are these things are? How do we define them? And having those conversations collaboratively so that then it can get that truth, that kind of truth that doesn't change fast, right? Yep. It's like we're at the lower pace level, right? Like, that is just the truth of the world. And that can get put into the code. We can even get our naming conventions, aligned with how a user thinks about it, how a business thinks about it. So it goes into the code, but then it also goes into the screens and the experience so that it matches the user's mental model. It matches all the people at Web Whiskey Weekend know that a bottle can go from year to year. And then if the system doesn't allow for that and take that into consideration, the system is just a little bit broken.
And it also allows everyone at every level, so business, design, development, support, everyone to be talking the same language, right? If you're using the same words to describe everything, it's much easier to communicate about potential issues or enhancements or everything else when you're all using the same words and describing the same thing. And you all have the model of how everything is working in your head. You don't have to understand the technicalities, but the general model concept, when everyone is speaking the same, it much clearer to from support tickets to feature, enhancements, it makes everything so much easier to discuss.
Oh my gosh. It's just like, I say this all the time. I cannot believe how much complex software we try to design where we're using different words for the same thing and the same word for different things. And then we try to go and design really complex shit. It's like, no wonder it's so hard. It feels harder than what it has to be. Vocabulary is like one of those first steps. Like, let's just like start speaking the same language here. And that doesn't mean that every designer needs to learn how to, to basically become a developer, and every developer needs to become a designer. Speaking the same language and being able to communicate really effectively.
Yeah. And it's important too. I mean, you know, this from all of your, the amount of sticky notes that you've written in your life is, naming stuff gets really hard sometimes. It's really difficult to come up with a name for this thing, right? Like, in a lot of times, bottle, I think, is a really convenient one as a join object for this thing that we are talking about. But a lot of times there's not an obvious word that's just like, oh, well, clearly it's this. So you have to kind of like really think through how to describe this. That's the big software joke, is the two hardest things in software are cache invalidation and naming stuff. the verbiage gets difficult, but it's a really important conversation to have.
Right. I mean, one of my ladies getting certified in this cohort five, she's working on a cat behavior app. And naming abstract concepts. So it's like to basically track like when your cat is pooping outside of the litter box. Shout out to Allie O. Nice. And so even naming the incident, like, is it an incident? Because sometimes it could be a positive thing that you're tracking. So does incident really the right word? And oh my gosh, we went back and forth so much on like, do we call it an incident? And then she has this concept of a tip. Like, here's something that you can do, like, spray this thing around the litter box. That might be a tip that gets suggested to you, but then you run an experiment where you actually say that you're starting to do the thing. Like now I want to put a timestamp on it. So now we have this inheritance of like, you have a tip and then you have an experiment that happens from a tip associated to a particular animal. Because you might have multiple animals in your house and like you start doing it with this animal and it just,
at a business level, then too, you can begin to evaluate the success of various tips and provide more and better things down the road. Yeah. Because you have all this data that's related. That's really cool.
I mean, 100%, you can create success metrics. And we have that as on our object guide or like glossary on steroids. One of them is like, let's decide what our success metrics are. for mm-hmm. each of these objects? Like, is it the number of instances that created? You were talking about how, you know, building out these relationships later, like building, like kind of like retrofitting, like if you don't quite get the database structure right and mm-hmm. the metadata right and all that good stuff, adding it in later is really hard. Sometimes you have to kind of,
a lot of work.
Undo yep. stuff, lots of rework. I often say my little slightly controversial statement is that information architecture should not be iterative. And I mean that, like, information architecture should not be as iterative as something as like UI design. It's different pace layers. You've got your fashion at the top that's fast moving, easy to change, move the furniture around, put up new curtain mm-hmm. rods, whatever, but you don't want to be moving walls and plumbing around.
Correct.
Iteratively.
Yep.
I want to hear any just general thoughts on that, but also like, how does that fit in with Agile?
Oh boy.
Breaking things up.
Yeah. Well, what it tells me is like everybody, like you have to understand and agree on what you're going to build before you build it. Like that's step one of making software. Like you can't just say like, oh, we're just going to make a thing. And so like, we'll just, you know, get a couple tables of data and then we'll figure it out down the road. It's like, I mean, you can, it just makes a lot of things significantly more difficult down the road. And when I say difficult, I mean like not just conceptually hard, but like doing data migrations oftentimes is a like multi step process that takes days, if not weeks, sometimes to actually accomplish. And it's really sensitive and it's really nerve wracking and it's painful. So like try and do that as little as possible by just, you know, thinking a little bit ahead of time about what you're going to do and how you're going to do it. There's the opposite side of that coin too, which is getting down the road and realizing that you should have been collecting some data that you weren't. Mm-hmm. And then realizing like, oh crap, we could have done so many cool stuff if we had just like timestamped these things when people were using it and been able to track success on those things. We didn't, you know, we thought about maybe that, but we never actually outlined that that's an important thing to store from the beginning. And so now you end up with, you know, just chunks of missing data that could be useful that would have not been difficult to add at the beginning. But now, you know, adding them down the road becomes tough because then you'll have like only some of your stuff will have that metadata and some of it won't. And so like that becomes, you know, a user experience challenge to say like, well, data, you know, this thing that happened after this point, we have some cool, useful stuff for, but ones that happened before, we don't have that useful stuff for. So we have to, you know, differentiate that visually or communicate that to the user somehow. It just adds a bunch of challenges going forward when you haven't put the thought into it to get everything that you want to store in place.
Like for example, going back to the cat behavior app, one thing that Ali and I talked about is, well, tip, the whole idea of a tip and like these suggested tips in this cat behavior app might not be like a phase one thing. Like that seems like maybe we need to get it out there and then we'll start like recommending solutions. But tips could very well be based on the age of the cat. So is this a tip for a senior or is this a tip for a kitten? Pooping outside the litter box problem and then tips might be like totally different for a kitten and for an older cat. So capturing age or like estimated birthday would be even better so that we can calculate age and the user doesn't have to update age. But going ahead and getting age from the cat now can like help us, you know, this is just a really simple example, help us with like the little algorithm that we're going to have to design to basically feed tips for particular animals. And so that's just an example of that, like thinking ahead, kind of casting this wide net and then saying, okay, well, what are we going to design now? Let's make sure we're not painting ourselves into a corner.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, capturing data and storing data is cheap. And it's much easier to just get rid of data that you thought might be useful down the road than it is to add data that you didn't get in the first place. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, as long as it's not prohibitive, to be able to think through like, yes, down the road, we might add this as a feature to the app. next year or later. And yeah. so we want to make sure that our data is organized in a way that that will slide in nicely and fit along with everything else we're going to do. Right. Yeah, that's a great point.
And I mean, just to, we have to balance that as well with not, you know, over asking stuff from, from users. Like I actually saw on Twitter this morning about, I think it was Karen Van Houten. She was talking about how, I'm sorry if it wasn't you, Karen, but she was talking about how Zoom to like, just do a trial account. They were asking her for her address. She was like, what? Like, don't ask. So we don't want to over ask. Or like, this is where some good UX writing can come in. So like, let's say we are asking for age. Let's be really transparent and say, hey, like, you know, have a little question mark, make it optional, have a question mark and say, this is why we're capturing it. We're really, we're going to be releasing this concept of, you know, of recommended tips. We'll be releasing this in the next 6 months. If we have your cat's age, we'll be able to better do that. And that can be just like two little sentences that shows that transparency. This is why we're capturing it. And here's our plans for the future.
Yeah. And again, that it really helps with, and this may be a good segue to prioritization. But like once you have all this stuff, you know, being able to look at it and saying, well, okay, this is too much stuff. So what do we, what can we get away with getting rid of? And what can't we, what is really important, you know, is showing that number that's really difficult to get just a balance thing? Or is it like, no, that's actually pretty key to solving the user's problem. And having those conversations becomes really useful so that, you know, like actually, we're going to skip that piece just for now.
Right, right. So so prioritization is something that was actually the Info Tycoon project that it like really came to light. Actually, so we have in the Orca process, like I was saying, there's like the discovery round, which is like, like, what are we doing here? What are all the questions? What are all the unknown unknowns? Often, well, you'll get kicked back to research because you'll realize you don't have enough, you don't know enough, right? Then you go into requirements where you like really put everything under a microscope, and then prioritization. And prioritization is basically, you know, prioritize the objects, prioritize those relationships, prioritize the CTAs, and prioritize the attributes from a business perspective, a user perspective, and a tech perspective. So, I mean, all three of those kind of coming in. What's more important to the user? What's going to be important to the business? What are the order of operations from a dev perspective? Like, okay, like this thing, I know it's not that important for the user, but it's just going to be easy for us to get this in. And it's going to make these other things easier down the line. Let's just go ahead and do it. So on what happened with Info Tycoon is we did like, it was pretty awesome. We had like 8 weeks of OOUXing, like just working on the object map. And it was like 23 objects. Like I actually use that object map as a example of like a very complicated system. There was a lot of inheritance. There was, you know, I mean, even just that inspection, there was like the company level inspection, the property level inspection, the inspection that somebody actually did, you know, on the, so this is for those that don't know what Info Tycoon is, it was software. I don't know if it's around anymore, for basically large apartment complexes. Inspectors to inspect, you know, is the refrigerator still working when somebody moves out? Like, do we need to charge them a fee? I did a whole lot of other stuff down to like capital expenditures. And anyway, we like did all this OOUXing, did it right along the side of this, the CTO and the dev team. And they were like, this is awesome. Like we can kind of see all the pieces that we're doing before we even do any wireframes. And then we presented it. I think we were presenting it to some investors. And so one of the investors said, so how long do you think all this is going to take to build? And the CTO looked at it and was like, oh, I don't know, like maybe like 18 months. And we were all like, whoa, oh man, okay. What we did is then we started, it was actually really easy to parse it down from there, to say, okay, these 18 objects are gone. Like, these six are phase two, these other ones. Yep. And these are the five core objects that we need. And then we can look at the attributes and be like, actually, like all of these attributes don't matter right now. Like we can pause on those. But what was great for the development team is then they kind of like could see the future a little bit And they were cinched in to this, like, this is what we're doing now, but we kind of know where we're going. So we can make design decisions from a development standpoint to set us up for that.
Absolutely.
Is that kind of how you have worked in the past as well, that you sort of like cast a wider net and then cinch in?
Yeah. A lot of times it's like, I mean, you have to have that brainstorm thing where you're just like throwing everything against the wall, you know, sticky notes aside. But you then, yeah, you have to be able to see, like, this is obviously too much. Like, but like, this could be a really cool thing down the road, but, and then you can sort of prioritize amongst there. But yeah, typically you'll, I'll tend to over object when I'm planning, and then, and then sort of pare it down based on like, well, that's like, now it's getting complex. And so like, let's see if we can rework this and then give me some prioritization on like, these are the core four objects. And then, from a development standpoint, that also lets me be able to program those objects to respond with everything that I need them to in the right way, so that like developing the page and the features becomes like, yes, please give me, you know, all the apartments for this building, because that's just a thing that's necessary. So I'll just build it so that it does that. And now it's pretty straightforward. The other really nice part about doing this from a development standpoint, and I don't know if anyone's ever like mentioned this to you, but when you have an object model like this planned out from the beginning, it's really easy to test your software to that data model. So like, you know, you can say, you know, every building has multiple units, and we need to be able to test that, like, you know, units can be added to a building, they can be removed, and like, that units have, you know, objects, and then you can write tests for all that stuff to make sure that your software performs in the way that you expect. And having that data model up front becomes like just a sort of a test map for like how you're going to write your unit tests.
Okay. Interesting. So designing from an object-oriented perspective, what I'm hearing is designing from an object-oriented perspective helps you write.
Oh yeah, it'll help you write better software, like from a development standpoint, because it's really clear what you're writing to. It's basically like, you know, you're just filling out the script. You know, you've got your targets, and you're just building your software to the target, which is a lot easier than like storing and building this stuff and then getting to a page and being like, oh, well, now we need this data out of it, and having to like, okay, well, how do I? Now I got to add this thing to make sure. And then, no, if you have all that up front while you're building the models, then you get to each page that you're going to have, and you're just like, yep, give me this data. It's tested. I know that data is correct. And it, you know, it's very specifically asking for this stuff. And I have these very clear and tested ways of getting that data to the front end. It's a really obvious way to do stuff.
But it's usually not being done.
No, or it's just
at least from a design perspective.
Yes, yeah. It's if it is being done, it's being done in a whole separate way from people that are, you know, not looking at that and just realizing what they have to test, if they're testing at all, which is another topic, I guess. But
right. So okay, so we got let me like pull back to Agile. Okay, so. Do you think, like, how would this type of thinking, this type of like, it's like medium design up front, maybe not huge, but like figuring out what are we doing, casting that wider net, then prioritizing back in. Like, a lot of teams don't have the time to do that. They're just in this feature factory where like the user story comes down. Maybe we have a really great design system, so we can just whiteboard some sketches. And then developers start building out that feature without the designers, you know, thinking through like, what are the objects associated with that feature? How do I make sure that that's consistent with this other object? Like, what even data do I have available? So how could, like, what we're talking about, does it fit into Agile?
It depends, like, is it, team, you sort of have to, anytime I've actually had any success with Agile, which is not very much, mostly because I haven't done a lot of Agile. I tend to, like, if it is this, like, well, we're going to go off some sketches and we're going to take 2 weeks to, like, spike out this thing. Every single time I want to do that, it's like, well, I'm going to, like, just test this out. I'm going to see if this works, but I'm not writing production code yet. Like, it's like, I want to throw some stuff against the wall and see, like, how does this work? And then, like, if it did work at the end of 2 weeks, if it's like, if it feels like this is the right direction, then we need to actually get more serious about, like, getting a lot more specifics about it, you know, how it works. It's fine to do these sort of, like, little spikes to just be like, yeah, let's see, maybe this will be really easy, maybe it won't. But you have to be in a mindset where, like, those are easily thrown away and redone. And not just like, you're not just like constantly adding duct tape on the outside of the ball. You're stepping back and rebuilding stuff that is in a core way to your application, and not just like taping new features to it 2 weeks at a time.
Oh my gosh. Yes. I think that's where we get this kludge factor that is almost inevitable, because we're just taping features together. Yep. Tell me how this sounds. So let's say we are doing this idealized Orca process. We have, like, good research coming in. Getting research into Agile is a whole other thing. But, like, let's say we have the good research, we start pulling it into this process. Designers and developers and business are all working together to build out an object map, to think through what all the things are. This is where maybe, like, there could be a day of that, maybe a day and a half. And then maybe the designers go and they, like, get punted back to doing some more research, maybe even, like, thinking through some of the details of the experience, while the dev team could take that object map and be like, okay, here's a little piece of this object map that we're not sure how easy it's going to be, or we need to do an experiment on that. So that could be the rest of that sprint, whether it's, 2 weeks or 1 week, they go do that experiment. It might be throwaway code. It might be working really nicely. And then kind of the team comes back together.
Yeah, I think that could work. I think there's also things that, if you agree on an object map, even at the beginning, I do love the idea of, like, just sleeping on stuff for a while. Because I find that, like, I'll build a data model that I think is really cool, and then I'll look at it 2 days later and be like, that was dumb. Why did I do it that way? This could be so much better if it was, let your subconscious solve some problems for you.
Right.
And so, don't just, like, build your data model and then, like, start building and designing your app the next, minute. Give it some time. But I think that there's certainly an aspect of, like, sort of proving the concept of that data model, whether that be through software or wireframes or anything else, needs to be a part of something. Like, even as a group, when you come up with a data model, you can't just assume that because we did this, that it's correct. Like, you gotta actually put it through some paces and make sure that it operates and behaves like you think it's going to, once you get into workflows and everything else. So
we're definitely over time, coming up against time here. We could definitely keep going and probably, I don't know, maybe solve the universe. But I do have one last question for you, about collaboration. I want to come back to, because you kind of are representing both parties, if you will. Mm-hmm. What do you want to see designers do to collaborate? Because designers are my main audience here. Other than, of course, UpToJoy and UX, right? Doing this kind of work, having these types of conversations. Is there anything else you would want designers to do to collaborate better with developers, or even vice versa, developers that you think developers should or could be doing to collaborate better with designers? What else is missing from this equation?
I always encourage people to just get in there and try building stuff. Like, you're going to be terrible at it. Like, the first app I ever wrote, it worked, but it was awful. But then the next one is a little bit better. And the next one gets a little bit better. Like, the starting point is not to become a developer. The starting point is to like write a couple lines of code that do something and it works. And then to do that again better next time. Mm-hmm. I think if you're building and designing software, you have to have like having a broad skill set and a broad range of like understanding and not talent, not like skill, mm-hmm. but understanding is important. And like, whether you're writing down some of this code or like building out some random stuff just so that you understand how it works, you don't plan to be writing applications. That's perfectly fine.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think just learning and talking about like, how does this get built? And like, you know, expanding your understanding of software becomes the best thing that you can do.
Right. Okay. So specifics, what language would you recommend?
Oh man.
Designer. If I'm going to go play just to, you know, not to actually build anything, just to write a few lines, get some better understanding. Yep. Where should I start?
I think for OUXers, I've been in like the Ruby and Rails community for, maybe not community. I've used those tools for years. And so to me, that's a really good starting point. But I think the reason I would recommend that to OUX people is because in Rails, for data modeling, there's this thing called Active Record, which makes creating data models and like actually interacting with the data really, really easy. Like, I think it'd be really interesting to kind of walk through some of that and show you just how straightforward it can be. Mm. But it lets you, like, if you understand the concept of data modeling, you can write like data, like applications in Rails probably within a day or two. Like, it's not particularly difficult. And I'm not saying you're going to be writing production level code that can work with, you know, millions and millions of objects and, you know, rows in a table, but you're going to write something that is like, you know, you're going to be able to keep track of, you write a task manager for yourself or something like that. That's like a good test thing that everyone writes. And just to see how that actually works. It's really empowering to be able to like, oh, I want this thing, so I'm just going to write that thing. It's a really fun tool set to have. So I would start there. JavaScript also is another great language to learn, just because it's so ubiquitous these days. Mm-hmm. But you know, I think for tinkering around with stuff on your laptop, Rails is great. I mean, obviously, tons of large companies are using Rails in full production mode with huge amounts of data. It's a very great technology, but for just tinkering around too, it's awesome.
I love hearing you say that. And I hear, so Amanda Worthington and I were kind of griping about this when we were all standing around talking about how when people tell UX designers that like, if one is saying that a UX designer should learn to code, a lot of times people are talking about HTML and CSS.
Yeah.
Great to know, but you're shaking your head.
Like, no, I like that is like, you know, if you want to be building design systems, yes, you should absolutely learn that stuff.
Sure.
But like, you're probably not going to be like you're right. As a designer, like you're going to be implementing stuff using a design system. But like, I think it's better to start getting down closer to the metal and like closer to how your data works and being able to pull, objects and data from your database and put them up onto a screen and use your design system to flesh those out into a UI is like the most powerful thing. And it lets you tinker with stuff, right? If you're no longer beholden to somebody else to like build this out to see if it works. You can just try it. I think it's super powerful.
That's really cool. All right. So we're going to get you on, do some OUX happy hour, talk about science on the OUX happy hour. I got all sorts. This is just like, you know, you give me an inch, I'm going to take a mile. Sure. And I can see like a really cool Ruby on Rails workshop. to
I think it'd be awesome. I think I
teach
think
OUXers.
Really cool.
Yeah, yeah. Like spend a day. So maybe we'll talk about that in 2022, where I can get a bunch of OUXers together and we can learn from you the basics of Ruby on Rails, like from that. Yep. Awesome. Okay, yep. Cool. You're on the hook now. All right. Steve, thank you so much. Awesome conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is a really important conversation. I'm super excited to get it out there. And thanks for taking so much time.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for listening. I truly hope you enjoyed this episode. Please visit objectorientux.com/podcast for show notes. Our soundtrack is Fighter by Ruby Vell, courtesy of Sugaroo Records. Happy OUXing!